what famous feat had worn away its pile? Had murderers stood chatting upon its once-red nap? There was a slight scurrying sound in the corner, the sound that a couple of mice might make when caught with the cheese, followed by a hollow groaning. Poppy Mandrill's ornate wicker bath chair came sailing smoothly into the room, like some ancient wooden ship under full sail, coming to anchor on the turkey carpet between the table and the tea trolley. Surely the lights were brighter at that spot than they had been when we came into the room. Surely we were now sitting in a slightly greater darkness. But it was the woman herself who commanded attention. I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. This was not the elderly invalid who had accosted me in the churchyard, nor the same harpy who had hissed into my ear in the pews of St. Mildred's. This was an Edwardian beauty in the full flush of high-coloured womanhood. Her skin was like peaches, and her eyes sparkled like happy diamonds. Belladonna, I thought, but I pushed it out of my mind at once. It would be a sin to penetrate such artistry, an affront to decency. We were entranced, and I knew it. Poppy Mandrill looked slowly and deliberately at each of us in turn, from Claire to Dogger and then to me, her piercing eye relishing, no, not relishing, but positively feasting upon our reactions. She was coolly judging her effect upon our widening eyes, making us her mirror. Her transformation was remarkable. From a frail and elderly invalid, this woman had summoned up a goddess. I'm afraid I gasped. "Welcome," Poppy Mandrill said in a voice like ancient honey, extending her arms, her palms upturned in a gesture of hospitality. "I bid you welcome to Alhambra House." Now I wanted to applaud. I was in her grip already, and I knew it, under her spell. But I didn't care. It was as if the very nature of time itself had shifted and taken us with it, a slice of time in which we sat frozen in a pretty little tableau, living insects in amber. Poppy was dressed in a classic white drapery, which I guessed was modelled on the Greek, overlaid with a large dangling Art Deco necklace of shiny Bakelite lozenges, each of a different vivid colour, a necklace for which the Duchess of Windsor would happily have sold herself several times over into slavery. We sat suspended for several very long moments in this charmed state until Dogger broke the spell. "Thank you for inviting us to visit, Miss Mandrill," he said. "It is most gracious of you to share your memories." Already her eyes were glittering like a snake's. This woman's metabolism burned recognition in the same way that an automobile burns petrol. She tittered slightly. "You mustn't press me too much, Mr. Dogger, for I am of frail and tender years." It was a joke, I suppose, and Dogger smiled dutifully. "Hypatia of Alexandria," he said, "Act 1, Scene 1. "You surprise me, Mr. Dogger," Poppy said. I turned to stare at him, but caught myself just in time. Dogger had surprised me, too. Just when I thought that I had got the measure of the man, he would reveal an entirely new and unsuspected side. "As a student, I was fortunate enough to take up residence in a theatrical boarding house," Dogger said. "Complimentary tickets often served as a common currency." Poppy Mandrill laughed a throaty laugh. "In exchange for what, Mr. Dogger?" "Favours," Dogger answered. "Friendship. Do you remember Frederick Lyndon Smith?" Poppy's face became a sunbeam. "Of course. He was Adagio in Return of the Homing Angel. Wonderful reviews. Wonderful. And Carlyle Quinn in When the Sleeper Awakes. Were you acquainted with him, Mr. Dogger?
I was, Dogger said quietly. He died a prisoner of war in Burma.
Dogger did not mention his own captivity. He was risking a great deal by opening this line of conversation, I realized, when even the slightest trigger, the most casual reference, could set him off on a nightmare journey of flashbacks to his own torture.
"Yes, I believe I heard something to that effect," Poppy remarked.
"Poor chap, Freddy. He had a great future." I bit my tongue, and from where I sat, it looked to me as if Dogger was doing the same.
"I believe he was once your protégé," Dogger said, "as was Orlando Whitbread."
Something glistened at the corner of one of Poppy Mandrill's eyes.
"You mustn't be too hard on me, Mr. Dogger," she said. "The flame must never be blamed for the death of the moth."
"Help yourselves to tea," she added, covering her own cup with an open hand when Claire offered to pour. Dogger inclined his head, accepting the rebuke graciously. Was he trying to encourage her to talk?
"All the world envies a woman like me," she said when we were settled.
"They think it heaven to have been the quarry of every male, young or old, who ever laid eyes upon her.
Let me tell you, it is not. The bull's eye on a target range has fewer holes than the heart of a woman on the stage."
"Oh," you will say, "but what about the gifts? The flowers, the food, the jewels, the attention, the applause?"
"Well enough when you are young, I suppose, and still blinded by your own beauty. But to someone of my present age, it is quite frankly sickening. One comes to fear the corpulent clergyman as the apple fears the worm."
"Aha," I thought, "the present vicar, Mr. Clem, and his loss of faith." How my heart was suddenly breaking for him, and for her. Claire, who had not spoken to this point, got up from her chair and moved toward the woman in the wheelchair.
"No," Poppy said, holding up a forbidding hand. "Sit down. The priestess must never be approached upon the altar."
"We must honour our traditions," she added.
Although she said this in rather a wry tone, almost half-joking, her meaning was unmistakable. Claire returned to her seat.
"Tell me about Orlando," she said softly. "I haven't yet been able to grasp." And in that instant, I suddenly saw through her. She and Dogger had planned this interview as precisely as a pair of generals craft a battle plan. They had rehearsed this conversation even before we set out for Alhambra House. They had rehearsed this little scene as carefully as any opening night in the West End. I kept my mouth shut in admiration.
"Ah, Orlando," Poppy shook her head. "Dear Orlando, he was too good to live. The world did not deserve him."
What was this? Was the woman confessing to murder?
"He was paying you a tribute, was he not?" Dogger asked. "I recognized the red ballet slippers and the blue silk costume at once as one of yours. Pyrrho in the Underworld. One of your greatest roles. A record run at the Aldwych. I remember it with great pleasure."
Poppy's only response was to touch her upper lip with a startlingly long forefinger, and for a fleeting moment her face was that of Pyrrho, as if the character had been flashed upon her face by some cleverly concealed magic lantern.
"He was going to recreate my role. We were going to recreate my role. To astonish the world, there would be no denying his talent."
"You understood him," Dogger said,
where others failed him.
Poppy nodded. It was easy to see how touched she was at even the mention of Orlando's name, which didn't mean that she hadn't killed him.
"Orlando's life was not an easy one," she said quietly. "His mother died before she could begin to love him. His father resented him in the beginning, hated him in the end."
"But why?" "I couldn't resist."
"There are children," Poppy said, "whose lives are shaped by the minds of their elders. It matters not a jot what they are in actuality, but what they are thought to be. Orlando was such a child, and such a man."
"Sad," I said, because I knew exactly what she meant.
"Infinitely sad," Poppy said, "because Orlando had in him, as I have said, the power to be the greatest actor of his generation, a gift from the gods."
"He must have been the envy of Volsthorpe," I said, putting it as gently as I knew how.
"Ho, ho," Poppy cried, her voice like that of an enraged hawk. "There were those who resented."
"The Three Graces," I blurted, as if I had just thought of it. I needed to flush this conversation out into the open to keep it from creeping back into the bushes. In spite of that, I did not say what was actually on my mind.
"His ease with women," Poppy went on.
"Meaning what?" I wondered. Was it possible for one woman to hate a man because of his ease with another? This was a question that was far beyond me. I tried to think of an equivalent problem in the world of organic chemistry, but I could not. I would ask Daffy, who had read Lady Chatterley's Lover, and accordingly knew everything there was to know about such things. I turned my mind back to the Three Graces and their swift departure from the earth. If not Canon Whitbread, who, then, had poisoned the chalice? Who, indeed, had dumped it in the river after the killings of the Three Graces?
"Look for the invisible ones," Dogger had told me.
And who could be more invisible in a parish than the minister's son? My heart fluttered at the thought. Was it possible that Orlando had poisoned the cup of the village gossips? He may well have had good reason to. "Where was Orlando on the Sunday morning, the day of the three murders?" I asked. Poppy was suddenly a hawk again, her wild eyes staring directly, perhaps too directly, into my mind. "He was with me," she said. I shot a glance at Claire. Hadn't she told me Orlando claimed to have taken the 702 up to London the previous evening? She gave me an eye shrug.
"Rehearsing," Poppy added unnecessarily, "and I testified to that fact at the time." "What actually happened that morning, Miss Mandrill?" Dogger asked, with a little shake of his head. "One reads the papers, of course, but I have never quite been able to get it straight in my mind."
"You are a clever man, Mr. Dogger, and a very pretty trap you have laid. But obviously, since I was with Orlando, I could not possibly know what took place in the church."
"Quite right," Dogger agreed, not fazed in the least. "I thought it might have been spoken about in Volsthorpe."
"And so it was," Poppy answered. "It was also widely reported in all the newspapers, which you admit to having read,
as did I, as did we all."
"May I help myself to more tea?" Claire asked brightly, getting to her feet and reaching for the silver pot. How much of this conversation had she and Dogger anticipated, I wondered. How much of it was spontaneous?
"You've come to me under false pretenses, Mr. Dogger," Poppy said in a scolding tone, as if he were a naughty boy. I saw that the spark had returned to her eye. "I fear your interest in my theatrical experiences was merely a ruse. Your motives are not those of the theatrical historian, nor are they of the merely curious. Togger did not protest, as I might have done if I were him.
"I offer my apologies if I haven't made myself clear," he said. "But as a once-avid student of the stage, I couldn't help being struck by the remarkable similarities of the murders to your role in Mildritha Kimboat. The three poisonings from the common cup were particularly suggestive. There is also the coincidence of the name, St. Mildred's."
The silence that fell clotted the air of the drawing-room. I hardly dared breathe. And then there came an insistent "ssss, ssss." Poppy Mandrill was hissing like a kettle through her teeth.
"You must forgive me, Mr. Dogger," she rasped, pulling a handkerchief from her sleeve and wiping at her mouth. "Perhaps you won't believe me, but that similarity had never occurred to me. Not until this very moment. You are quite right, of course. Do you suspect some connection?"
"No," Dogger said. "I was merely pointing out the remarkable coincidence. In my experience, murderers in real life have neither the wit nor the ingenuity to plot and plan such literary crimes, let alone carry them out. Killers do not read books, nor do they frequent the theatre. They are more often to be found in cinemas or wrapped in the Daily Mail."
Poppy Mandrill let out a dry chuckle. "Touché, Mr. Dogger," she said. "I am properly chastised. I should have known better than to bait you. Your point, of course, being that such fiendish killings occur only in the books of Mrs. Christie and her ilk?"
Dogger gave her a slowly beatific look. His face was suddenly that of a weary but understanding archangel.
"And, of course, in Volesthorpe," he said.
Although I could see that they were both taking a certain pleasure in the duel, it was time to remove Dogger from the line of fire. I knew the signs all too well. I reached for my teacup, and as I raised it to my lips, I let out the most appalling gut-grinding belch. It was an art that Daffy had taught me as a child, and one which I had perfected over the years in the privacy of my bedroom and my laboratory. My belches were not for the faint of heart.
"I'm sorry," I gasped, covering my mouth and holding my breath just enough to make my face go a convincing shade of red.
"I suddenly don't feel well. The piggy's in a blanket at breakfast, perhaps." I let out another train of injured air. Dogger and Claire were on their feet at once, bustling me toward the door and making their apologies. It was a performance worthy of Poppy Mandrill herself. Had she spotted it as such, I wondered. I kept my shoulders hunched like a vulture and my hands over my mouth until we were in the rolls and safely away from Alhambra House. Only then did Claire and I burst into hysterical laughter. Dogger smiled a tired smile, and I realized that it really was time to get him home. After dropping Claire off at Skull House, "Just leave me at the edge of the field," she had insisted. We drove back to the Oak and Pheasant in near silence.
"Phew," I said as we got out of the car. "It's been a long day already. I think I need a rest. You might as well have one too, Dogger."
"Thank you, Miss Flavia," he said. "I believe I shall." In my room, I stood on my head on the bed, as I sometimes do when I need to concentrate my thoughts. Why hadn't I asked Poppy Mandrill about Orlando's peraldehyde habit? I'd certainly had the opportunity. It was almost as if some powerful hand had held back my questioning, and perhaps for good reason. "All's well that ends well," Shakespeare had said, and, as usual, the wily old bard was right. It might not have done at all to let Poppy know how much I already knew about the characters in the case. When I woke up, the shadows of late afternoon
had subtly rearranged my room. I got up, washed my face, and brushed my teeth. Daffy had become remarkably fussy about personal hygiene in the past several months, and I didn't want to give her an excuse to carp. Chapter 23. I tapped lightly at Daffy's bedroom door with my fingernails, one long, followed by two short, a Morse code letter D for Dickens, the password we had agreed upon during one of our rare truces. After a moment, I heard the key turn in the lock. "Well?" she demanded, peering out at me with one eye through the crack of the opening door. "How are you getting on with the poems?" I whispered, keeping my voice down in case Mrs. Palmer was within earshot. Daffy eased the door open wider, just enough to let me squeeze in, then closed it behind me. "Listen, Nugs," she said, putting her hand on my shoulder, and my heart leapt up. She had not called me Nugs for years, not since we were children. "Listen, Nugs, these are deep waters and dangerous. You'd be a fool to become involved." I was too stupefied to speak. Daffy led me over to her bed, patting the quilt to indicate that I should sit. Mrs. Palmer's book, The Muscle Bed, lay open face down on the counterpane, which ought to have told me something in itself, since Daffy had raged more than once that anyone who left a book in that position ought to be flayed, hanged, drawn and quartered, and dragged by four black horses to the four corners of the globe, their tattered remains roasted and the ashes cursed and scattered to the winds. Daffy snatched up the book and read. "This one, for instance, about the copper mare and the brass stallion. Remember? The copper mare and the brass stallion graze in Flecker's field. He paws the turf while she the wind tastes, and when he trots to her, she turns tail." "Of course I do," I said. "It's about Leander, the ancient Greek chap who drowned trying to reach his lover Hero, who was a nun."
"It's about horseplay," Daffy said, "and not the kind you're thinking. James Elroy Flacker died in bed, remember?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said, and I didn't. Daffy's mind and mine do not function in the same way.
"Do you remember Madame Bovary?" she asked. "Remember Rodolphe, the gentleman in the yellow gloves and the green velvet coat?"
"Holy moly," I said. "You don't mean..."
"Indeed I do," Daffy said with a leer.
"Mrs. Palmer?" I asked.
"I don't believe it."
I still wasn't exactly sure what Daffy was referring to, but I didn't need the details.
"With whom?"
I asked, managing to keep my head grammatically.
"With her Leander, the one who drowned."
"Hold on," I protested. "She wrote this poem and published it ages before Orlando died."
"Which can mean only," Daffy said, "that she either foresaw his death or was herself the instrument of his demise."
"Ah," she said, "is there true love beyond the grave? Does the drowned hero await in some violet-scented afterlife?"
"'Fraid not, Flavia. Marvell said it best. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace."
"Nope. You can count on it, little sister. The woman's either a psychic or a killer."
"Top draw, Daff," I shouted. "You ought to be in the detecting business yourself."
I was amazed to recognize that there was no resentment whatsoever attached to my words. My sister deserved all the praise and encouragement I could give her.
"Go on," I urged. "Is there more?"
"Tons more. Steaming cartloads of it."
That did it. I vowed there and then to take up the study of poetry at the earliest possible convenience.
"I'm all ears," I said,
putting my forefingers behind my ears and pushing them forward until I looked like Dumbo.
"Well, this, for instance," Daffy said,
turning to a new page and striking a dramatic stance. Her voice was different, I noticed, when she read poetry.
"'Tis not the hawk that frightens, but the shadow of the lark."
"'She is more afraid of the songbird than the raptor,' I interrupted. "'I wonder why?'
"'The Linnaean classification of the skylark is a Lauda arvensis, meaning field lark. Arvensa is a Latin word for field, recalling both Flecker and the field in which the copper mare and the brass stallion graze. And our trusty landlord Palmer's Christian name is Arvin. It's on the hanging signboard out front.
Of course it was. Hadn't I seen it with my own two eyes?
That did it. I resolved to take up the study of Latin as soon as we were back home. I was already drooling at the thought of those mountain torrents of leather-bound texts in Buckshaw's overflowing library. What juicy secrets lay hidden in forgotten names.
"Sorry," I said. "Go on."
Daffy gave me an amused raised eyebrow and began the poem again. "'Tis not the hawk that frightens, but the shadow of the lark. Most melancholy bird of all espies us in the dark."
"An owl," I said. "Owls can see in the dark. Someone has spied on them in Flecker's field."
"Partially correct," Daffy said. "Someone has spotted them, but it's not an owl."
She closed the book, sniffing at its sandwiched pages, as if gratefully savoring the knowledge they had given up.
"Most melancholy bird," she said, "is an allusion to a poem by John Milton. Surely you've heard of Paradise Lost?"
"Heard of it? I had lived it. Paradise Lost was the story of my life."
"Vaguely," I said. "Excellent," Daffy said. "The reference to a melancholy bird, however, as every schoolboy knows, is from one of his earlier poems, Il Penseroso, which, roughly translated, means the thinking man."
"And what is the thinking man thinking about if he's not referring to an owl?" I asked.
"It's a poem about his muse and how she meets her lover."
Daffy fell into her rich, dark reading voice.
"Oft in glimmering bowers and glades he met her, and in secret shades of woody Ida's inmost grove."
"Quite frankly, Flavia, it's about an assignation."
"Well, that put a whole new light on things."
Had Mrs. Palmer's husband realized what was going on and killed the man who was meeting his wife in secret shades, whatever that meant?
"And the bird?" I asked. I was not about to be thrown off the track by a lot of nauseous lovemaking. "A nightingale," Daffy said. "The melancholy bird of which the poet speaks was a nightingale."
"There are times when the breath is sucked out of your lungs, as, in an instant, a forest fire consumes the living air." Giddy and light-headed, I made my excuses, sudden fatigue, and fled the room.
"Wait!" she called after me. "There's more!"
But my head was spinning. I needed to be alone. Now. When all else fails, there remains a single spot on earth where one can be alone, a place where teeming thoughts can be rounded up and organized, a place where one will never be imposed upon by the inhabitants. And, as if of their own accord, my shoes were already making their way across the road to the graveyard. All I needed to do was to keep my feet in them. Here I could collect my thoughts among the ancient stones. Would I sit here with Fanny Greatorex, spinster of this parish, who departed this life on the 3rd day of April, in the year of our Lord, 1906? Or over there on that mossy bank with Thomas Button, gent, whom life abandoned on November 31st? That's what it said, in the 59th year of the reign of our sovereign king, George III? Since Fanny looked a little more welcoming, and somewhat less damp, I chose her. I settled myself among the lichens on her slab. There is something mystical about sitting on a stone. It not only provides firm support for one's bottom, but also seems almost miraculously to stimulate the brain. It was obvious that Orlando Whitbread was central to what I had already begun to think of as the Volesthorpe mysteries, as tangled a knot of death as I had ever seen. The man himself was dead, as was his father, as well as the three village women who had perhaps gossiped too much about him for their own good. The good canon had gone to the gallows for the deaths of the latter three ladies, and now his son would be joining him, more or less, in the grave. There was so little left to go on. Perhaps it was too late anyway. Perhaps we should simply pack our picnic baskets in the rolls, drive off into the sunset, and leave these dead to their own devices. Given enough time, it wouldn't matter anyway. Or would it? Would Flavia Deluce blot her heavenly copybook by overlooking a crime? 4 crimes, a little voice cried within me. Would all the saints, when I arrived in paradise, rub 4 fingers together at me as if starting a fire with sticks, and cry out to me, "Tish, tish, tish"? Would a choir of angels chant, to the tune of some grand and previously unknown melody by Bach or Handel, "Shame, shame, 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 Flavia's going down the drain"? With heaven, you never knew. It was better not to take any chances. A twig cracked, and before I could even think, someone seized me from behind and covered my mouth. I had only a flashing impression of rough red hands and a hot, rasping breath at my ear. "Keep quiet," hissed a voice. My eyes must have been bugging out above the restraining fingers. I did the only thing I could think of. I bit them. "Ow!" shrieked the voice as I was abruptly released. "You filthy little minx! You've bitten me! I'm going to lose a finger!" I spun round to see Mrs. Palmer. She was staring at her bleeding hand, which had distinct teeth marks on the web between her thumb and forefinger. My instinct was to make a break for it and run for my life, but her next words stopped me. "Wait. I probably deserved it. I was simply trying to keep you from crying out and attracting attention. It's my fault entirely. I should never have followed you in the first place. I thought we could have a quiet talk." She looked at her injured hand in a way which I believed is called rueful. "Why didn't you simply walk up to me?" I asked, handing her the handkerchief Mr. Clem had thrust upon me. "Why didn't you just hail me from a distance?" "I thought you'd run away," she replied. "I thought you'd think I was going to kill you. Just as I killed Orlando." "Did you?" I asked. "Kill Orlando, I mean." "No," she said, wrapping her damaged hand in my now ruined handkerchief. "I most certainly did not, but you believe I did." "Do I?" I challenged. The conversation was becoming like one of those absurd French dramas in which the characters stand about swapping nonsense dialogue while the audience pretend they know what's going on. She did not reply to my question, but dug deep into the pocket of her apron with her undamaged hand and pulled out a roll of banknotes. "Here," she said, holding it out. "Take it. It's all I have. I can get more later if you insist." I looked at her blankly. "Just leave. Go away. Ask no more questions. Leave us in peace." It took me several moments to see what she was getting at. "Are you offering me a bribe?" I asked. She shook the money in my face, then tried to press it into my hands in what, because of her injured hand,
was rather a gruesome gesture, all blood and banknotes. I did not take them from her, but neither did I refuse. I needed to keep this conversation alive until I had what I needed.
"Who else is blackmailing you?" I asked.
Because I had broken into her bedroom, it was probably not a good idea to bring up the brass stallion and the copper mare. I didn't want her to think me a snoop.
"Ah," she said with a wry grin, "I see you've been talking to your sister Daphne. Serves me right. I ought to have known better than to trust anyone who reads Trollope."
There was a long, uneasy pause, and then she reached with her good hand into her apron pocket and pulled out a packet of cigarettes and a book of matches. She made a clumsy effort to get one alight, but her fingers were shaking badly. I lit a match and held it for her, in spite of my aversion to the habit. There we were, inches apart, staring into each other's eyes.
"Orlando," I said,
and I watched as her tears welled up instantly at the sound of his name. Surely this woman could not have...
"Orlando was a very special soul," Mrs. Palmer said. "He did not belong upon this earth."
"Who killed him?" I persisted, thinking of her husband. She took a deep drag on her cigarette, sizing me up with tired eyes.
"You shouldn't listen to gossip," she said, exhaling a trumpet of smoke brutally. "Gossip kills."
"Sometimes there is no other choice," I insisted, "when you can't get at the facts." I was quite pleased with myself for having thought of this. She was already halfway through her cigarette, staring now at the horizon.
"Orlando, like many artists, was not strong-willed. He suffered from an abundance of addictions."
Which was rather a neat way of putting it, I thought. Wine, women, and song, and peraldehyde, all without actually mentioning any of them, all swept under the carpet with all the efficiency of Mrs. Mullet on a Saturday morning, and Aunt Felicity arriving unexpectedly from London.
"Talent is a terrible task, mistress," I remarked, picking this shockingly trite bit of rot out of thin air. I was ashamed of myself, but still rather proud.
"It is indeed," Mrs. P. said, dabbing at her eyes with her bandaged hand. "His father was so very, very proud of him, and yet..."
"It must have been very difficult for Canon Whitbread," I said. "It is often best to lead with a general remark and leave the other person to release a flood of details. But in this instance, it didn't work."
"Yes, it was," she said, and left it at that.
I detected some awkwardness developing. I needed to be more personal.
"Mrs. Palmer," I said.
"Greta," she blurted. "Please call me Greta."
She was as anxious to be chummy as I was. Chumminess invariably leads to confidences being exchanged, which, when you get right down to it, is what the art of detection is all about. Sleuths learn nothing by being aloof. It was the one thing that the great Holmes got wrong.
"Greta," I said, "I'm curious about just one point. Perhaps you can set my mind at ease."
"Brilliant, Flavia. Make it sound as if I'm the one who is discommoded, which doesn't mean what you probably think it does."
Before she could even think about it, I fired away.
"Where was Orlando on the morning the Three Graces died?"
I already had two answers to this question. Poppy Mandrill claimed he had been with her. Canon Whitbread's prosecutor insisted he had gone up to London.
"Presumably at home at Skull Cottage," Greta said. "He had just come down from London the day before."
"Hold on," I said. "Gone up to London, you mean? Saturday, the night before the murders?" "That's what Claire had told me." Greta laughed. You see how stories get muddled in a time of murder? He had, as I say, come down. I know because I picked him up at the station.
From Dollylands, I said. He had just been released from the private clinic.
Yes, she agreed.
Then this is my question, I persisted. Was his treatment successful, or was he still under the influence of paraldehyde?
What would you know about that? She demanded.
If she'd had feathers, they'd have been ruffling.
I shrugged. I needed to find out if Orlando, at the time of the poisonings, was shot full of paraldehyde and in the grip of the delusions and hallucinations that sometimes accompany its use. I could feel the resistance. She did not want to reply.
It all came out at the time of his father's conviction, she said bitterly. You can read about it in Great Trials.
I don't have a copy of Great Trials, I said gently. And besides, I'd rather hear it from you.
Why are you doing this, Flavia? She asked, fumbling for another cigarette.
Because I trust you, I rejoined, suddenly inspired.
That did it. Greta began to talk. Orlando had been in and out of several institutions and private hospitals, all of them promising, but none in the end, providing a cure. Dollylands was the end of the line. They admitted only the most badly addicted patients. He came down on the Saturday evening train, went straight home to Skull Cottage, and, as far as I know, injected himself with the stuff immediately. He came into the Oak and Pheasant an hour later, and I bustled him out the back door into the garden. You could smell him from across the room. He was extremely agitated, went on and on about his reputation ruined, his good name grabbed from him by gossips. He was receiving vile letters, said he had no choice but to involve the police. I told him to go home and sleep it off. It was dreadful. He cried, and so did I, but not until later.
And did you see him on Sunday?
No, apparently no one did. He claimed to have been lying in Skull Cottage in a stupor until the Monday morning after the murders.
Thank you, Greta, I said. You've been a great help, and I meant it.
I'm glad of that, she said. And now I want you to drop the whole thing. Orlando is dead, but there are still many secrets in Bowlesthorpe. Some of them will come out and some will not. None of us need the trouble. Take this, go home, and forget about us.
Again she held out the roll of banknotes.
Keep the money, I said. I don't take bribes. I'm not that kind of person.
What kind of person are you? She asked, and I could see that she was offended.
I'm the kind of person who is going to make a difference in the world, I told her, as soon as I get rid of my braces.
Greta began to laugh a low, slithery laugh, like a snake in the grass, but the laugh died in her throat like a shot pheasant. A man's voice nearby was calling out,
Greta!
She seized me by the arm and pulled me roughly down behind a weathered tombstone.
"'It's Arvin,' she hissed. "'My husband. He's come after me. He's going to kill me.'
"'Why would he want to kill you?' I whispered.
"'You don't want to know,' she whispered back, clutching my elbow to her chest as if it were a life jacket. I did not bother telling her that I already did.
I peered round the edge of the tombstone. Arvin Palmer was standing about 30 yards away, looking round, scratching his head.
"'Can you see him?' she whispered.
I nodded yes.
"'Just keep still,' she pleaded. "'Arvin has no patience. He'll give up and go away before he'll search the churchyard.'
"'You know him very well,' I said. She shot me a grim grin.
"'Too well,' she said. "'He may have no patience, but he never forgets a wrong.'
ever," she added.
We sat for perhaps 10 minutes in silence, our backs against the tombstone, before Mrs. P. scrambled to her feet.
"I'm leaving now," she said, brushing off her skirt. "I'll go the long way round. But promise me this, Flavia."
She waited until I met her eye. "When Constable Lotter gets round to questioning you,
don't mention my name. Please, I beg you." "I thank you. Goodbye."
She touched my hand and then she was gone. I lost sight of her before she reached the river.
Chapter 24. I had hoped that Hob would be at his father's shop. It would have made things so much easier. As things turned out, it was probably as well he wasn't. I stood in the street gawking for a few minutes, as I always do when I want to be taken for a tourist. There were no funeral notices in the window of the Nightingale shop, which came as no surprise. A set of faded and threadbare purple curtains hid whatever lay behind the plate glass. I cupped my hands against the window and peered through them, hoping to somehow see what lay inside. Nothing but a brace of dead flies. I tried the door, but it was locked. No point in going round the back then. I didn't want to be seen trespassing upon private premises. What was I to do? As so often happens, when you are a girl of intelligence, the answer was already right there in my head, ready for immediate use, like a celestial screwdriver. I remembered sitting once, only half attentive, through one of Denwin Richardson's lazy summer sermons on the Book of Matthew. Perhaps it was because Denwin often recirculated his winter preachings that they were sometimes so memorable. In any case, it was a message I had heard more than once. "Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened." What a wonderful text it was, and how appropriate. I closed my eyes, folded my hands, and asked. It was in that instant that I remembered the wool shop just down the street. I turned away and strolled casually toward it. The bell over the door rang, and I stepped into the shop.
"Good day to you," said the woman behind the counter. She was sitting in a chair, knitting. I couldn't help thinking that she was vaguely familiar until I realized that she looked uncannily like a sheep herself. I pretended to interest myself in her balls of wool.
"Do you knit?" she asked.
"Not myself, no," I said. "But my Aunt Felicity does. She's a wizard knitter. She's promised to knit me a Fair Isle pullover if I can find some wool of my favourite colour."
"Which is?" the woman asked.
"Peacock," I said. The woman put down her knitting and began to haul herself out of her chair.
"Peacock?" she asked.
"Yes," I said enthusiastically. "It's one of my school colours."
"And your school is?" she asked sceptically.
"Miss Bodycote's," I said. "It's Canadian," I added, as if that explained everything. Without another word, she shuffled off toward a little back room, as I had desperately hoped she would. In a flash, I had seized a couple of crochet hooks from a display on the counter and rammed them into my pocket. I could have paid for them, of course, but I didn't want to leave such an easy trail of evidence, should I happen to be caught. I would balance the books later. The woman, blast her, was back in a jiff. She dumped half a dozen balls of wool on the counter.
"Peacock," she said proudly. "It's on sale. I can let you have the lot for 6 shillings.
I picked up a ball and fingered the wool.
"Oh, dear," I said. "I'm afraid this is Indian peacock. Miss Bodycote's is Javanese peacock. Miss Bodycote herself, you see, was brought up in Batavia,
The Javanese peacock is said to have derived its unique green color from the volcanic nature of the soil there. I gave her my most horrid know-it-all leer, as if to confirm this mixture of fact and fiction. At the same time, although I could hardly believe I was doing so, I offered up silent thanks to my obnoxious cousin Undine for her endless prattling about wildlife in Singapore and the former Malaya.
"That's fine, then," the sheepwoman said in that voice which means that it isn't really.
She stuffed the wool under the counter and resumed her knitting.
"Thank you," I called loudly and cheerily as I walked out the door. "Lovely shop."
I took my time walking back along the street to the Nightingale establishment, pausing again to look at nothing in the window. I stood with one hand idly in my pocket, bending one of the crochet hooks into a letter L. When it seemed about right, I took it out and applied it to the lock, using the other hook as if the two of them formed the jaws of a pair of pliers. Dogger had given me extensive training in the art of picking locks. This was just one of the many accomplishments he had picked up in his earlier life. I would have loved to ask where and how and why, but of course one doesn't do that sort of thing. One merely listens and observes. As if by magic, there was a deeply satisfying click and the knob turned easily. After a quick glance up the street and down, I stepped inside the shop. This was not the first time in my life I had reconnoitred an undertaker's shop. The trick of it was, of course, to find out what I needed to know without being caught. Although it might seem like a good idea at the time, meddling with corpses is difficult to explain in the cold light of day. First thing, then, was to determine if Orlando's body was actually here. An arched doorway to the right led to a small chapel in which several rows of straight-backed chairs faced an empty wall. Nothing here. To the left were a pair of double doors, which caused my heart to beat a little faster. Double doors are made for the wheeling in and out of things that cannot walk themselves. I tapped lightly on the panelling, just in case someone was inside. I could still explain my way out of this. I was looking for Hob. I had found the front door ajar, and so forth. I pushed the door open and peered inside. This was more like it. The inner sanctum, the control room for the Empire of Death. Two tilted slabs of porcelain with drains stood side by side, both of them, unfortunately, empty. Glass reservoirs of what I knew to be embalming fluid were close at hand. Their contents tinted the shade of candy floss to restore in the subject what was believed to be a healthy complexion. On a wall, stainless steel surgical instruments, one of them a colossal syringe with a snout like some prehistoric mosquito, stood ready to extract stomach contents and so forth. I gave a thought to the dead Orlando and to the contents Dogger and I had analyzed from his stomach. What were they called? Diatoms. Yes, that was it. Diatoms. Those microscopic creatures whose sandy skeletons had told us whether Orlando had been dumped dead or alive into the river. In any case, he wasn't here, as I had half expected he wouldn't be. I was beginning to get that familiar feeling at the back of my neck. Not out of fear, but out of a sense that your hunches are more than hunches. I backed out of the room and turned to face the remaining door, which must lead, I knew, to the workshop, which I had already seen on my previous visit. Again I knocked out of courtesy, as I make it a point never to startle a man with a hammer in his hand. The same dark and beautifully polished coffin stood as it had before, on trestles in the middle of the workshop. I flicked the finish with my fingernail. Mr. Nightingale had certainly put a lot of work into this masterpiece of the carpenter's art.
Again, I wondered who it had been made for. In a far corner of the room was a desk, bulging with papers and letters, which spilled out of its many pigeonholes in a most haphazard manner. As I took a step toward it, I brushed against a chisel which had been left lying atop a wooden trestle. It went clattering to the floor, and I froze. The Nightingale's living quarters were probably upstairs over the shop. Had I been heard? I stood listening for several endless moments, but all I could hear was the pounding of my heart. I tiptoed my way to the desk. By their dry, faded paper, I could see that these documents stretched back over many years. It appeared as if Mr. Nightingale had begun filling the top left pigeonholes in the early days of his business, and moved on from side to side over the years and down. The fresher-seeming envelopes were in the bottom right compartment, spilling over onto the desktop. I pulled the drawers out one by one. These, too, were jammed with bills and invoices. I pulled one out at random. It was 3 years old. The next drawer down was a complete surprise. It was filled, almost to overflowing, with loose race cards. Cheaply printed Greyhound racing programs from Wimbledon, Haringey Arena, Southend Stadium, and the White City. Certain dogs in each race checked off in pencil, presumably to win, and every one of these, I realized, purchased with the wages of death. With races on weekdays and at weekends, afternoons and evenings, and the sheer amount of travel involved, his commitment in time must have been colossal, to say nothing of the money wagered. And suddenly I knew Mr. Nightingale was no angel. He was also in deep trouble. It was just then that something caught my eye, a fat, solemn-looking ledger that lay flat on the top shelf. I reached for it and took it down, my hands trembling. Inside the front cover, on the flyleaf, in a remarkably ornate hand, was written in businesslike black ink, Oak Gall, I thought, F.T. Nightingale. The first entry in the book was dated 13th of September, 1922, and had to do with the funeral of an infant named Margaret Rose Corfee. In meticulous copperplate script were written the details of the transaction. Attendance at the Laurels, 10 shillings. Pine coffin, 8 pounds. Shroud, 7 shillings. Ribbon, 2 shillings. Motor hearse and driver, 2 pounds. Opening grave, bearers and sexton, 2 pounds. Undertaking, 1 pound. All of it coming to about 14 pounds. Poor little Margaret Rose Corfee. Had anybody loved her? They surely must have. The ribbon told the tale. I turned toward the back of the ledger, which was not quite filled. There were only a few blank pages left. The last entry had been made 2 years ago. I whistled. Canon G. L. O. Whitbread. The bill had been paid in full by H.M. Prisons. The cost had been £560. There were no details. And there hadn't been a single entry since. With fingers flying, I leafed back to the previous page, and there they were, the three Graces, Miss Willoughby, Miss Harcourt, and Miss Cray, all on the same day. It must have been a bumper season for Mr. Nightingale. But why, then, had his business so suddenly failed? Why had he only carried out 4 funerals in the past 2 years? I needed to dig deeper into his personal papers. If only I could find his checkbook, or perhaps his diary. Even the mail that he had received might well shed some light on his most peculiar business. I was trying to decide where to begin on this mountain of papers when I spotted something on the floor, something which had been flung carelessly toward the wastebasket, but had fallen short,
almost hidden behind the leg of the desk. I picked it up with my fingernails. Unfortunately, it was blank, just a piece of blue-lined paper from which a portion had been torn.